believe that's right. Yep. Oh, you even recorded by yourself?
I just hit record just now.
You're amazing.
Yeah.
There we go.
High five for that. Nice. Okay. Okay. All right. Are you close up on me right now? Okay. Stop. Stop. That's my attention grabber. So like when, you know, how it goes in the feed and then all you see is that. All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Not Boring Business Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Redman, founder of Air 5. This is not suits and handshakes business. This is not boring business. Let's go. Yep. I've got my friend, mentor, business lover, David Arthur's with me. How you doing, Dave?
Hey, how you doing, Jeremy?
I'm telling you, I love that you're here. Thank you so much for coming.
I love that you invited me on. I'm really super excited.
Oh, I can see it. I love this. Okay, so you came all the way from Palm Springs just to be with me, right?
That's right.
Oh, so I feel so loved.
At 8 o'clock in the morning.
At 8 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so I wanna give the viewers, give the Not Boring Nation a little bit of oomph at the beginning. So I constantly say, just in the startup realm, that a mark of a good leader is getting people at least initially excited to work with you or even working for you for little to no money, right? And I say, like, because if you can lead people, you can, like, no money, right? That's my outside of the box take. Now, what do you believe is the mark of a good leader?
Well, you know, that's an interesting, you know, today we have a lot more support mechanisms for startups than we used to have in the past. And in the old days, and when I first started working in startups, you did have to do sweat equity and you did have to bootstrap yourself.
Absolutely.
And there was one company in my past where I went for 2 years without collecting a salary.
And, oh, wow.
And that was took an awful lot of faith in, you know, what you were doing, and that it was eventually going to have, you know, some payback, some benefit. But I think, you know, today, sad, you know, state of affairs in the startup realm, we really have kind of a crisis in leadership. And, you know, we see it right now in the, you know, the sexual harassment scandals. We see it in the, you know, the Uber. We've all read the horrifying accounts of how female colleagues are treated.
Absolutely.
At Uber. And it even goes to other larger mainline companies that you would think that, you know, they would have, you know, definitely solved this problem and created, you know, the type of environment where, you know, everyone, a diverse workforce, can feel welcome and can work without fear of being bullied or harassed.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's, I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. A lot of people are actually wanting this to go back in the closet.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I think that we're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg, and it's going to go beyond sexual harassment and go into actual on the job or in the job work environment is bullying.
Bullying.
So, yeah.
And I obviously, have you seen this video of the kid where, like, he was being bullied, like in the, he was, it was his mom. He took a video of him, like, in the car, and it was this little kid that was being bullied in school. Mm. Like, have you seen this video?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's like making its rounds, and now a lot of celebrities are like, hey, stay strong. Like, obviously the whole it gets better thing. And like, someone from the Avengers invited him, like, to the premiere. And I'm like, I can't believe, so I've never, I don't think, like, growing up, I was ever bullied, but I don't believe, I never did any bullying either.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
sure you didn't.
No, I promise. So, like, I really feel like I always felt like you had that. I always had empathy, like, growing up.
So that right there, I think that's a key word. You have to have empathy for the people that you work with, the people who work for you.
Ah.
And, you know, I think that, you know, we don't have any empathy for our coworkers. And, I mean, but it does actually go, when we're talking about sexual harassment, we're talking about, you know, bullying or harassment on the job, we're actually talking about toxic individuals.
Okay.
And a guy wrote a very good book called Toxic Workplace, which came out many years ago. He's recently published a new book. It's called Why I Don't Work Here Anymore.
Okay.
And, okay. You know, yeah, pretty basic, you know, pretty basic title. But the book and, you know, the message he's trying to get across is oftentimes the price that companies pay, you know, and, you know, particularly talk about the situation at Uber, people just quit. They just quit and go work someplace else. And it was too much trouble, too intimidating to try to, you know, change the corporate culture. Because the you know, sort of the corruption, you know, goes all the way to the top.
Yeah.
And a fundamental lack of leadership.
So like in Uber's case, right? Like I see, how does that, like they talk about scaling culture with uh-huh. startups. How does that culture survive? How is that culture able to survive in a $50 billion company? Like growing all the way up, right? Like I don't understand how that starts, right? Like where that CEO, and we just won't name him, but it's like where he creates or enables this culture of sexual harassment, like throughout. Like I can only imagine starting my company with three people and going, I think it starts with the first person that you hire where your culture starts.
Right.
Like, and I heard once in college maybe it was you, but like, if you don't create a company culture, one will be created for you.
Right.
So like, is it an absence of leadership early on? Or?
Well, no, I think in these particular cases, there is an active effort to create a culture, but the culture is, you know, basically a culture of disrespect and a culture of bullying, culture of, and there's this, I think a false, it's actually paradoxical that they think that they're actually getting more work done, that actually they're getting less work done. They're intimidating people. People aren't able to contribute. People aren't able to, you know, people are not able to actually participate in the idea forming process because they're afraid that they're going to get fired. They're afraid that they're going to get, you know, somehow penalized or called out or, you know.
Right.
So, you know, this I think is, you know, one of the key things for anybody who's starting a company today is to go back to considering, you know, I mean, it's kind of a Wild West thinking, isn't
sure.
it? You know, let's do whatever we, you know, whatever we need to do to win, which is, you know, I love winning more than anything else.
Yeah.
Every, you know, I was thinking what is, you know, the most disappointing, you know, thing to me as a business leader, and the most disappointing thing is losing a sale.
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
Yeah, so
what we thrive on, after all.
Yeah, so you know, these are, you know, sort of competing, you know, sort of competing objectives, and the thing that I go back to is, you know, your moral compass,
yeah.
you know, and behaving ethically and doing the right thing by people and standing by your word and not trying to break laws and not trying to step on people and see how far you can get.
Yeah, right.
You know, I've definitely seen this in some previous jobs where, you know, the CEO in a company I worked for a decade ago, he, you know, basically, you know, tried you out as a doormat. And if that, you know, when the doormat, you know, said, get off of my back, he finally, you know, treated you with some, you know, small amount of respect.
So when that person fought back.
When that person fought back. Yeah.
I think that is that bully mentality, right?
Yeah.
Like that's what they say. And I don't, I'm completely ignorant to this where like the whole, I understand that it happens. The bullying happens. It's there, right? Like. I don't know if it's, but we both grew up in the Midwest, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's obviously there. I just didn't experience it in like that kind of form. You know, like is it, and you always hear about it, like, hey, you just have to fight the bully back, right? Like, because he's smaller than you are.
Yeah.
Inside.
And when, when it really becomes problematic is when the bully is, you know, the boss of the company.
Right. You know, and that is such a different,
And how do you, you know, how do you fight, fight back in that particular case? And that's, you know, getting back to that, you know, why I don't work here anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Kind of, you know, the title of Mitch's book. So,
oh my gosh. Okay. So I have, workshop this with me for a sec. I was just talking with my fiance yesterday about having a quote, like a massage, like a, either a massagist, it's not a massagist.
No, massage therapist?
Yes.
You're putting two words.
I was. Yes. That's what my thing is going. And like, so
you're going to have a misogynist come in.
Yes. 100% and berate everyone. No, I was hoping to have this massage therapist come in, mm-hmm. right? And where people could just badmouth anything they want. But nothing could leave that room. Good or bad idea? I was just thinking about this. So, like, do you think it's the ability for... And then she said this. Well, you might take this approach. She said, but if they're coming in and badmouthing something about the company, wouldn't the CEO want to be alerted to this, or wouldn't a couple of these other things? And I said, well, I think some things just need to get off people's chests, and they don't really want to take action with things. They mm-hmm. just want to come in and complain about Rick, you know what I mean, or Eric,
right,
about whatever he's doing. What do you think about that weird strategy?
So
just designating one person to, like, hear people's bullshit.
Yeah.
In a company.
So you mean a message therapist.
A message. Yeah. Okay.
Not a massage therapist.
Yeah, right. I was hoping they could give massages.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, right. You know, you'd have them, you know, right. They'd be rubbing your back while they're
that's what I'm thinking.
Simultaneously, yeah. You know, working out your
you're talking through the little hole thing. You know,
that's
you're
right.
Sitting there, right? That's what I'm thinking. Good or bad idea?
Yeah, so it's a difficult thing because – trying to get candid feedback from people is difficult. You know, I've seen some companies where they bring somebody in from outside, usually in an HR consultation level, and interview people, and that has been successful. I was part of a mirror exercise. Mirror exercise.
What is
yeah? So exactly? Mirror exercise is where this is what they did to us. So they went and they interviewed the most vocal. So an outside consulting firm came in. They interviewed the most vocal people in the company. So they specifically asked, "Who are your complainers?" So so we gave them, you know, here's a list of complainers, you know, and this is a larger company, and
you can't say who it is.
It was at Open Table.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but I mean, it's nothing.
Sure.
You know, there's nothing shameful about exercise.
Yeah, right.
But the experience of it was quite interesting because they took all the feedback, they created quotes and snippets and put them on boards, and then and they were themed. You know, so like this is what people think about training, and this is what people think about, and. They made the executives walk. It was almost like going through a memorial.
Oh.
So we had to walk through the boards and read all the, you know.
I love that.
All the comments. But the thing that was confounding to me was, you know, you would see one, you know, employee complaining, I don't get enough training. Mm-hmm. And then on the other, you know, lower down in the board was another feedback quote, we spend too much time training people. And so, you know, I walked away actually feeling like the exercise was,
right.
Kind of a exercise in futility.
Yeah.
And maybe it did allow people to complain and it did bring some things to people's attention. But oftentimes, issues are individual or departmentally isolated.
Right.
So while one department is spending too much time training and doing too many seminars and not getting enough work done, other departments are not training their people enough,
right.
Or according to the opinion of one person.
So how did they fix it then? Like, or Were you high enough? You were a higher ranking.
Yeah, individual. I was an executive.
Right. So, like, how was that fixed? Did you voice that concern there? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
Okay. Yeah, I did. And they asked us how we felt about, you know, the exercise.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it kind of made me a little angry, actually, because there was, you know, there was no rebuttal, you know, and oh, okay. some of the comments that the employees made were a little unfair.
Were they, did you took them personal?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, not personally, but, you know, definitely, you know, any company, you know, introspects on itself. There's things that you can do better, and you should constantly be improving and doing things better than you were doing before. But in this particular exercise, I didn't feel like we had an opportunity to really leverage what we were reading in constructive ways, because the company was fairly large at that point. And so maybe this complaint was coming from customer service or sales, and, you know, how can I in engineering, you know, have an impact or make a change to my department to address a complaint that's really isolated to a particular group. So it was not really terribly actionable either.
So was it divisioned, right? Like, were the complaints, or were they just literally quotes?
They were grouped. They were grouped by theme.
Theme.
So yeah. So they
theme,
had to.
As
yeah.
In?
Theme like, you know, training and education.
Oh, okay.
You know, so
theme of complaint.
Theme of complaint.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, that was an example where somebody came in and, you know, did a really deep dive into, you know, what was going on within the company.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, I think to some degree that can be very helpful.
Yeah.
If it is constructively done, I think, you know, we lost opportunity to have that kind of feedback in that particular case at the department level.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to actually act on anything.
Right. Okay. So we kind of jumped into this leadership thing, and then we took with it, and now it's been some time. But I want you to give just a little bit of background on yourself. Now we'll come back, and
sure.
Then we'll come back to that piece.
Yeah. So you know, pretty much, I'd say I've become a serial entrepreneur. I'm worked with 5-6 different startups during my career, couple of which I founded, all of them. To this point, found exits. You know, you could debate whether they were happy exits or not.
I think they were pretty good exits, right? Like decent exits.
Yes. Well, not all of them.
Oh, not all of
not,
them.
Not all okay. of them were decent exits.
How many complete utter failures did you have?
Zero.
Oh, zero.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that's batting 1,000. Does it not feel like that to you? Because you've tasted such like a great success.
And well,
like, and these ones just don't measure up.
And getting back to leadership, you know, we're talking about that. Every company that I have worked for, I really strongly believed in the product and strongly believed in what we were doing. And, you know, there's almost a religiosity to it. You know, your heart and soul is vested in the business's mission.
Sure.
In what you're trying to do. And it's really important as a leader, as a founder, to really understand your why. Why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I, you know, why am I excited about the company? You need to share that excitement with your employees. You need to get them vested in the same why.
Right.
You know, so I think that you know, everything that I've done, I've been super excited about the product. I've been super excited about, you know, the market, and, you know, felt like I could see the opportunity. I could see the, you know, and I can talk about probably one disappointing exit.
Go.
You know, we were doing, this was during the dot-com boom, we were doing a college-level library. And
a college-level library?
Yes, online library. So okay. Completely digital college library.
Got you.
So the idea was that college students were going to pay $19.99, you know, or thereabouts, subscription per month to access a library online. They do their research all online. And the product was really cool, and it could do some really cool things. And, you know, searching, as we all know, searching text using computer is a whole lot more powerful than trying to do it through the library.
Absolutely.
And those of us who are 100 years old and remember Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature and going the old-fashioned way, going to microfilm and, you know, going that route.
A microfiche.
Microfiche.
Fish?
Microfiche.
Fish? Okay.
Microfilm.
Is it film? Is it film, fish, or fish?
I think it's fish.
You think it's fish?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, microfiche.
Microfiche.
Tiny fish.
That's exactly what it is. Okay, sorry to
off-track
you.
So, you know, really cool product, really super powerful product. The market were was college students. Mm-hmm. And, really made sense that, like, every college student in the United States would want to be using this product.
Makes sense to me.
And it would make, writing papers super easy. Unfortunately, we misjudged the value of $20 to college students. That's beer money. And when you can go get something for free, and when you can go to the library where there's boys and girls to socialize with, you're also, saying, we want you to pay $20 a month and we want you to stay in your dorm room and do your work.
Right.
So we were actually also going kind of against cultural. So I think we raised around $150 million. I mean, give or take.
What?
Yeah.
You never told me this.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was really a interesting period of time. Board of directors was kind of a who's who of Texas money folks.
Yeah.
We had Ken Lay, the former CEO of Enron.
Yeah,
Chairman
of
Enron on our board of directors.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we had Barbara Bush on our advisory board.
Wow, yeah. Look at you.
So we had, it was a real exciting time, let me tell you. but, we misjudged the market.
Yeah.
And there was no market for the product or not a large enough market for the product we were selling. And, I put a lot, actually invested some of my own personal money into the company.
Sure.
And lost it all and lost my job in the process as it downsized. The company.
How long did you make a go of it?
So I was there for a little bit over a year. And it was, probably one of the hardest periods of work in my life where we were working literally around the clock. I would go home as the sun was coming up. And I would take a nap and come back and start over again at 10 o'clock in the morning.
See, we take naps right here in the office.
Yeah.
A few times. You don't have to go home anymore.
Yeah. But it was a pretty, it was not for lack of effort and execution. It was just, the market was not as big enough as anticipated. And the company did, regroup and it did, come back and find an exit.
So two questions there that I'm going to interrupt you with. One is, how in the fuck do you raise $100 million but misguess the size of the market?
Well, we had a blue chip group of people backing us. We needed a lot of money in order, back in those days, digitizing books was expensive. Hmm. And we had to buy the rights to the books. So we were actually, the justification for the fundraising not only went to the marketing, but also went to the process of digitizing the books.
Got you.
So it was a very expensive process to digitize a book in that time. And we were also the founder, Troy Williams, he was a Harvard lawyer, a graduated lawyer. And, his inspiration for this was NexisNexis, where you could, say, give me all Jeremy Redman's criminal charges.
there are plenty.
Yeah.
This would be a big database.
But this, you could ask these very specific questions. And so we were not only just digitizing the works, but we were also tagging everything.
Okay.
And, trying to create value by tagging names and places and, everything. There was a lot of work that went into the preparation of the material.
Yeah.
And so, we really did build a really high quality product. and the product is still there, a company still still in business,
yeah, sure.
Operating under a library, you know, library online.
So the product is still around?
The product, oh yeah, still around. Oh, wow. Yeah, they did. They did find an exit. No, they didn't pivot. They just eventually got absorbed into a larger library services company.
Oh, okay. Mm. Interesting. All right. So,
that was the worst
you'd ever had.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the one that exited to OpenTable.
Yes.
We've had so much dialogue back and forth about that. And like, just it inspired me and kind of lifted me up through like some of my hard times, some of the things that you went through. And there's one story that I absolutely love. And I hope you can share this. Like, if not, just let me know. But like, it was one time where like you had to go to the board and because you couldn't afford to like pay people, and you were like just a week or so from not doing. Can you please tell that story?
Yeah. So,
and like how that felt.
Felt?
Like, yeah. Tell me how that felt, like not being able to going through that.
Yeah. So, we built a decent product. We were not, we had some kind of systemic issues within the company, as a lot of startups do. They dealt primarily around, sales and billing. So we had some dysfunction and, so we got to a point where, you know, we were basically out of money, and, we had an angel investor who put about $750,000 into the company.
Nice size chunk.
Yeah. And, that definitely, pushed us to another level. But like most startups, you sometimes have difficulty actually getting to that next level. And we needed to make some fundamental changes in the structure of the company, which meant laying people off, which is always a very difficult thing to do.
Right.
And how did I feel at that time? Well, I felt.
How many people were there?
So we had probably about 10 people working for the company.
Okay.
And we were basically scaling and converting people into subcontractors.
Okay.
So we really dropped our headcount down to like 4, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And, in order to be able to, make payroll. And, so it was a pretty significant change, and I felt an obligation. I felt a very strong obligation to the investors, to try to pull this thing out of the fire.
Yeah.
To try to turn this around, and we basically I and another co-founder kind of took over. I was in charge of product and engineering. She was in charge of operations. And so Claire took over the process of billing and dunning the customers. And I took over sales and, sat down with the salespeople and said, anything that you can sell and get a deposit in today, you can write it, you can basically do any price you want to do.
Oh, sure.
And we had a couple.
It was a fire sale.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we had a, we were probably sitting on a couple $100,000 in uncollected debt from our customers.
Wow.
And so Claire went to work collecting that money.
Gotcha.
And by the end of the quarter, we were cash flow positive.
Wow.
So, but.
How did you collect all, like, did you guys hire a psychological hitman?
Well, we did hire a professional. Yeah. We did hire one of our advisors.
Did you?
Yeah, gave us a person to actually do the collection.
I only hear about them. Like
I wouldn't call her a hitman.
A psychological hit, you wouldn't call her.
She wasn't a hit woman either.
Okay.
But she, very professionally contacted the customers and said, you have an outstanding bill and
nicely like that.
Yeah. And okay. When do you think you're going to get the check in? And, through that period of time, it was really dicey, whether we were going to survive or not. And, I kid you not, we didn't have enough money for payroll or for the rent or something, and we would go to the mailbox and open the mailbox, and there was a check, you know, which is exactly the right amount of money we needed to cover.
Oh, right.
And, you know, and everything came in. And then something else happened at the same time. This was right around Great Recession. And so...
yeah, what year was this?
This was 2007.
Okay.
And the Great Recession was starting. And that was actually a surprise boost to business.
Mm.
Because OpenTable, our competitor at the time, was much more expensive than we were. Suddenly, restaurants were looking very closely at what they were spending.
Oh, shit. Nice.
And so we were a lower cost option at the time. And that actually worked tremendously in our favor.
Did you start like hard positioning toward that?
Yes. Yeah. And particularly as an enterprise product.
Sure.
So we were going after groups, large groups. And we were starting to pick off groups. And then that was primarily... you know, when OpenTable came and acquired the company.
Were you looking for an exit, or was it serendipitous?
Well, we would have been happy probably to have continued, you know, doing business, you know, and continuing to try to grow the company. And
yeah.
We'd had conversations with OpenTable previous to that, where we said, you know, we've got some partnerships, we've got some things that we're doing that we want to see how they turn out before we, you know,
mm-hmm.
before we totally throw in the towel. But, yeah, no, they definitely, you know, it was in hindsight, you know, we probably would have done better to have given it a few more years, development, but, you know, it was the right thing to do at the time.
So what could have been better? You're saying like a better exit? Or
we could have gotten a better exit. Yeah. Had we waited, you know, going, you know, doing an exit during the height of the Great Recession, you know, particularly as things were kind of turning around for us, we probably could have done better if we waited another couple of years.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that I love about that one story about the check in the mail. Mm. So like, I believe you speak things into an existence, right? Like you work your fucking ass off. Mm. And I know we've had a couple of conversations about this. Like I said, I look at these houses every day. That's why I sat my chair here.
Uh-huh.
So that I can visualize getting one of these houses, right? Uh-huh. Like it's this or a box on the street. Like I fully believe that. Like it's all or nothing.
You visualize yourself in a box on the street.
Like I default. That's my default. That's my vision. But so, do you believe in like it is like the law of attraction, right? Like you put your you
everything
put it out there.
Yeah, everything always. Yeah, everything always works out.
Yeah. So like. One person actually asked me one time, I had this question posed to me. Does money just seem to come right when it is needed most? And I'm like, weirdly, yeah. Weirdly, like I get a check for the company right when I need it the most. Right when I'm like down and out. Like, uh-huh. I can only imagine like the thoughts and feelings that are leading up to that
moment. And you know, perseverance, I think, is probably the most important attribute a startup founder needs to have.
Whoa. Nice.
You know, it's most people fail in business because they throw in the towel.
Mm-hmm.
They give up before they succeed.
Yes.
And I had a conversation with a guy in San Francisco who was talking about how he was working for a company. It was Digital Puppets or something like that.
Digital Puppets, way
back in the day. And they were trying to do a company that would have been perfect for the internet before the internet really happened.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just before the internet really happened. And, you know, he was lamenting how they shut the company down basically like 6 months before the internet became a phenomenon.
Wow. And, damn it.
Yeah.
Digital puppets, man.
Oh
my gosh.
Oh. You know, and they could have, you know, and it was a virtual reality, you know, game or.
That seems way ahead of its time.
It was way ahead of its time, but, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, that a lot of things that people are doing are ahead of its time.
Sure.
And, you know, even, you know, people look at OpenTable and think, you know, the company has been hugely successful. It wasn't always so. There were some very difficult times when I. Went for a couple of years without a salary. OpenTable was restructuring and going through, a decision point whether to continue, you know, they had laid off a lot of people. They restructured and refocused.
You went without a salary at OpenTable?
No. Oh, okay. No. Oh. What I'm saying is, well, we were starting GuestBridge. That was right after 9/11 and the dot-com bust.
Gotcha.
And during that period of time, you know, while OpenTable today is, you know, a very successful company, at that particular time after 9/11, nobody was going out to restaurants. Nobody was, you know, we were in basically a hospitality recession throughout the country.
Right.
And, you know, restaurants' appetite for new technology was not there. Selling, you know, basically, I remember our first sale. We went to talk to this guy. His name's Alex Brennan Martin, part of the Brennan's family from New Orleans. And basically, he looked at our product and he said, when you can do, you know, this, and that, you know, get back to me and I'll, you know, I'll buy your product. But it doesn't do enough, you know, it doesn't do enough for me to want to buy it. And I liken it to the, you know, the Wicked Witch of the West. You know, if you can bring me back the broomstick, you know, the Wizard of Oz gave her an impossible task.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, bring back the broomstick of the Wicked Witch, and then, you know, I'll talk to you.
Right.
Well, that's, you know, in his mind, that's an impossible task. She's never going to get the broomstick away from the witch.
Right.
Well, that's what he was, you know, he basically, you know, said, bring us, you know, bring me back the witch's broomstick, and I'll buy your product. And it took him quite seriously, and we went off and we built all the features that he'd wanted, came back, I think it was 60, 90 days later, and said, here it is.
Yeah.
And he was like, shit.
Oh.
Now I've got to buy your product.
Yeah. And did he?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yes. He was our first customer.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, normally, like, and I just think about this product-wise, you're way more of a product guy than I am. But, like, you got to hear, like, hey, we need these features from more than like one or two people before you start building them. No?
Well,
unless it's a huge sale.
Well, there's that, but there's also, you know, the vision and the common sense of what you're trying to accomplish as a product.
Sure.
So you take, you know, input from customers, but you have to filter it with the idea that they're going to, they may, you know, see a hammer and see something to pound with it. That may not be the best, you know, they may need a screwdriver.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's up to you to kind of, you know, as a product manager, as an engineer, to kind of think through, you know, what their actual need is, and provide them the best possible tool. You don't just go do what the customer asks you to do without looking at it within that lens.
Yeah,
that
right.
Lens. But I'll say, too, I saw a talk by Bill Gurley at South by Southwest. You know, super, he was on OpenTable's board of directors, super bright guy.
Cool.
Always very interesting. You know, maybe you can get him on
on
the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. he was asked a question, you know, can you predict the success of an entrepreneur based on their prior experience? And he said, you know, B2C, he's like, no. He's like, I can't even predict B2C.
Mm.
So when you're trying to get a product adopted by, you know, by a mass audience,
sure.
You know, like if you'd asked me what I thought of Twitter, when.
What did you think of Twitter?
I thought it was ridiculous. I thought the idea was ridiculous. Sure. Maybe it will be, turn out to be ridiculous.
Yeah, sure.
But.
You'll be proven right in the next few years.
Well, not yet. Not yet. But when Jack Dorsey started Twitter, you know, I thought the business idea was crazy. You know, like who's going to send 140-byte, you know, messages back and forth to each other?
Sure.
I was kind of shocked when it took off. So there's things that, you know, products that I've seen that I thought should take off. And, you know, revolutionizing the way we do things that don't. And right. Then there are things that do that I'm surprised that they do. So you can't, so it's very difficult to predict. But when you get to B2B is a little bit easier because you can block and tackle. And this is, I'm quoting Bill Gurley here. you can block and tackle your way through the problem. It's a little easier, you know, when you're dealing with a mass marketed product, you kind of have to feel your way through it in the dark, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, and there's a lot of A/B testing, a lot of experimentation, and that testing, you know, is very difficult. You know, weird things like, you know, oh, changing the color or the font, you know, suddenly makes a difference in whether you're selling or not.
Sure.
This is kind of crazy.
Right.
When you're going B2B, it's mainly about what's the product do and what's a functionality. And you can, you can pretty well block and tackle your way through that.
Absolutely.
And you know, as far as competition goes, you can create a better product. You know, you can always strive to create a better product than a competitor.
So how do you handle it if it's a two-sided market where one is you're selling B2B and another one's your consumer product?
Yeah, so, you know, of course, OpenTable and, you know, some, you know, look at...
Oh, yeah, true.
You know, OpenTable's... OpenTable's a two-sided market.
Right.
So it's B2B and B2C. And, you know, one of the things that I think was really important about the strategy that OpenTable followed was, you know, building a, you know, the transactional restaurant, basically focusing on the B2B side, basically making, you know, owning the management of the front of house, which hadn't been, you know, there really were very few products in the market before GuestBridge and OpenTable existed for running your restaurant, managing a restaurant. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, building a good B2B tool, you know, solidifies the, you know, the supply.
Yeah. Sure.
And then you have to stimulate demand.
Right.
And, you have to have them in the right, you know, it's like starting a fire, you know, you start with kindling and mm-hmm. you get out of balance. I actually thought, you know, Uber did a really great job in creating that two-sided market. They came up with a, you know, pretty well-defined formula for how to go in and open new markets. They go in, they sign drivers up, and they pay them. You know, they basically give people a bonus to sign up as drivers prior to there being any work. And then they blanket the metropolitan area. They focus on small areas. They basically
like boroughs of New York or like, well, or are you, I don't talking know, about a city.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, how this, small are you talking?
This is like, Ithaca, New York, or, you know, like the blanket Ithaca with coupons and discounts.
I never knew what their like initial rollout strategy was.
Yeah. So they basically, you know, and they've done this so many times that they know exactly, you know, how much stimulation to do on the demand side and on the supply side. To ensure, because, you know, they could coupon all they want. If there's no cars available,
sure,
it's not going to work. If
right.
there's no demand, it's not going to work. So they know exactly how to stimulate both sides of the equation, and they do it in a very concerted, direct way. And to me, I think that's, you know, that's really brilliant that they figured that out, and they follow a very standardized practice around that.
So what's the second step? You open in a smaller market, and then you get drivers first.
Right.
And then how do you get the demand for the drivers? Like, you have to do it simultaneously. There has to be like a big bang, or
that's
in this
right.
case, like a
smaller
bang.
It has to be coordinated, right? Yeah. And you know, they're very coordinated. So they. Basically, you know, everything, they decide to go into a market and boom, boom, boom.
So tell me this, driver one, right? Driver one in, I don't know why we're...
I don't know if I can go into that much detail.
Like, that's what I would like. Like, I would love to explore that, right? Like, I'm starting an Uber 10 years ago.
Yep.
I get driver one. What do I tell driver one?
I think, you know, and I'm not, you know, an expert on Uber history, but I think they started in San Francisco with black cars.
Okay.
You know, that was the initial, you know, that was the original initial market, and the original initial product was a black car. And they just kept expanding and, you know, ratcheting on to that. And I think Lyft is the reason they went into the less expensive, you know, what we typically consider an Uber today. They went down market because of competition. And that's another thing too that I want to stress is, you know, if you do
explain
have,
down you, market you, versus up market.
Well, up market would be the higher priced black cars, limousines.
Got ya.
Down market is your, you know, shared ride.
Got
you.
Ya,
know,
okay. Where you're, yeah, the pool.
You're doing Uber right. pool.
I've never taken an Uber pool.
I have, and it was not a good not a good experience.
I'm not pooling anywhere.
Yeah,
like I feel like I'm paying my 12 or well, I guess sometimes in LA if it's traffic, like I'm paying my $30. I'm getting to the airport.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well,
I don't know.
I would pool home from the airport.
I can't imagine you pooling home. Like I can't imagine you pooling.
Pooling home from the airport was actually cost effective and pretty efficient until I got kidnapped.
What?
So the Uber algorithm went haywire, and basically, I was rider number two, and they drove past my house and went downtown, dropped off the other rider number one.
Oh,
drove halfway back to my house, and then got a call to pick up rider number three, and had to go back downtown again, drop that person off. Started driving me home, and then got a call to pick up rider number four back downtown again. At that point, I told the driver, stop, let me out of the car. In the middle of nowhere. And he wouldn't let me out of the car.
Wait,
because
why?
There was no way, he had no way of getting me out of the car, I guess. Because
click the button.
I guess, Oh
my gosh. I was going to say, at what point did you not just go, I've been in here an hour now, like drive me home.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that bad, but it was,
that's a one star
it
rating.
Was getting close to an hour. Yeah. And you know, so that was my last Uber pool, and probably
there you go.
One of my last Uber rides.
Okay, so I want to get this one question in. So like I always stress that I love to talk to like regular people. Like, I just feel like regular people en masse offer me way more value than pound for pound than, say, if I were to sit down and talk to someone who I believe, which was influential, and I sat and took notes, right? Mm-hmm. I can learn much more about going on the street and talking to someone about my product than I can about talking to Bill Gates, right?
Mm-hmm.
About my product,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I feel like there's an intellectual disconnect there where I can learn more pound for pound with people. Mm-hmm. Would you rather talk to people on the streets or someone that you believe is influential, like a Bill Gates or someone, a visionary product person?
Well, first of all, I talk to everybody.
There you go. There's a way to like,
so
hedge
there's
the
nobody, question. Nobody gets away.
No one gets from, away from your from, gravitational
from,
force
from me. Well, no, and I wouldn't say that. I'd say more, you know, I'm you know, pretty outgoing, and I'm I think a good listener.
Yeah.
So that's the other aspect is, you know, when you're talking to people, you have to look for the, you know, you have to listen very carefully what people are saying and really understand. This gets back to what we're talking about in the beginning of the podcast about empathy, you know, and empathize with your customers, empathize with the problems and you know, the things that people are struggling with. So, you know, I think I do a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I, you know, definitely, you know, would love to know what Bill Gates thinks about,
you,
anything he has a opinion on, but, you know, everybody's opinion is valid. And I think,
what if you had to choose?
So yeah, let me actually, you know, kind of, relay something to you about our culture. So we, as Americans in American business, we tend, particularly in Silicon Valley, create very, you know, egalitarian, democratic
mm-hmm.
Processes.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I'll say about my experience at Open Table, it was a very collegiate environment where, you know, you could have conversations about how to approach things. You know, we really did try to, you know, to do the best for our customers. So as we had this expression, win for three.
Win
so,
for three?
Yeah, win for three. Actually, I might be misquoting that. But basically, win for the customer, for mm-hmm. the diner, win for the restaurant, win for Open Table.
Gotcha.
So if we were trying to do something, we were challenged to think of things that were going to be successful for, you know, both our supply or demand and our company all together, you know, so do things that, you know, benefit everybody.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it was a very collegiate environment where, you know, ideas, you know, could come from anywhere, from anybody. And, you know,
I think that's my most broad point, right? That's the point I make there, which is most people would be like Bill Gates out the gate, right? Like they don't believe they can find even anywhere near as much value from regular people.
Yeah.
And I believe that to be true. I believe you can find just as much value.
Yeah. And you know, you need to, you know, people need to be wary of the most expensive opinion in the room. You've heard this expression?
No, I haven't.
So basically, if you walk out of a, you know, a meeting with a decision that the highest ranking person in the room came up with, you really should question whether that's the best. That's actually the best solution to the problem. So
why is that?
Because people tend to give weight or value to high, you know, rank within the company.
Okay.
And that's less so in American business culture. But, you know, working with some foreign companies, you know, it is very, very top down and very, you know, I had a conversation with one company and the staff had moved to an American style open floor plan. And the guys, the lowest level guys that were working customer service for the company, said there are no walls in the office, but there are many walls. So they still, you know, the hierarchy and, you know, and everything in within the office was still preserved, even though they were, you know, kind of faking an American approach to running the company.
Interesting.
And you know, even you know. The startups that I've worked for, no one has an office. Even the CEO doesn't have an office. CEO probably has like a conference room that they use a lot.
Got you, okay.
But they don't have an office.
Yeah.
And everybody works on the floor together, you know, very egalitarian, very, you know, open environment.
Okay.
No assigned parking spots, you know, no status associated with, you know, with higher, I know you have an assigned parking spot.
I do. Thanks a lot. Okay, perfect. That's amazing. I want to thank Dave for coming.
Yeah,
thanks. I love you, man.
Yeah, thanks. You're the greatest. For having,
yeah. And Brennan, for working the controls. But
hey, there we go.
For working the controls. Thanks a lot. I'm sure it's going to turn out great, right? If it doesn't turn out great, I'm coming after him. I'm coming to small
yeah.
for you. All right. Thanks so much, Dave.
Yep. Bye.